This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thank you for downloading this programme from the BBC. This programme is part of World War One on the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/ww1.
I'm Dan Snow. Welcome to Voices of the First World War. In the years leading up to the centenary of the war, the last of those who actually experienced it have passed away. But the Imperial War Museums and the BBC had recorded interviews with many veterans to try to capture what it was like to actually be there. This series listens to those stories.
The night was terrible because it was long, it was cold. We were always waiting for the German to kill us in the trenches.
We'd have stand to until it was really dark, then we'd all get really down to it.
But in the night time, you're more awake really than you are in the day, you know, because you don't know what's happening in front there proper in the night time, and you're listening as well as looking, you know, and you can't see, but you're listening.
There was work for everybody at night time. The sentries would be doubled, and we'd have patrols out the front, wiring parties out the front, ration party detailed to go off and get the rations behind, down at the wagon lines, water party go down and get water in, ammunition parties, trenches to be made up, and that would go on to about midnight, 2 o'clock. Then, of course, the ration parties would be in, the water party would be in, but the work on the trench would go on all night. The work on the wire had gone all night. The patrols would be out all night. So night time was a very, very busy time. You had no rest at all.
Oral history takes us back. It's not an accurate record of dates and times. Instead, it's highly personal. A subjective account of what a fellow human being has experienced. It evokes empathy. The veterans in this series remember the climactic battles, but also the mundane hardships, the grind of industrial war. The night harboured terrors. Sometimes our veterans, recorded years later, sound nonchalant. Other times, the memories are still raw. Henry Williamson contributed to the BBC Great War series in 1964.
When the frosts came, we could walk about on hard ground, and we could also sleep. But our boots froze while we were sleeping. It was painful. So some of us walk about at night and swing the arms to keep warm. The greatcoats, of course, were frozen, and the yellow clay that was on them was frozen too. Very hard to get it off. It was a great weight. Being stiff as boards, we just hacked the skirt off about 2 feet up from the skirt with bayonets and walked about in short coats. Many of our chaps went down with frostbite. When the boots were taken off in the billet, the feet swelled up like tomatoes, and some of them got gangrene and had to lose their feet. Can you stop a minute?
We were continually cold all the time, cold and wet and the damp. And we were in the line on one or two occasions with the Indian regiments, the Gurkhas particularly. And we felt so sorry for them because they'd been brought straight from India and they came into this damp, wet weather that we experienced in Flanders in those days. And of course, they got pneumonia and they died like flies.
One night in the second week of November, there was a tremendous storm of rain, lightning, flares still going up, water raindrops splashing up 9 or 10 inches in no man's land, and it went on and on and on and on. The condition of the latrines, you can be imagined. And we couldn't sleep. Every minute was like an hour. And when were we going to be relieved? We were told we couldn't be relieved, we couldn't.
We got quite friendly with the Gurkhas, and one felt extremely sorry for them because they had marvellous guts. They didn't complain, they went about with their teeth chattering. And it was really very sad to see them. We kept them well supplied with body belts and mufflers and things like that. Of course, our aunts and mothers sent out numerous woolen garments. And so we were very pleased to pass them on to the Gurkhas. However, the sort of time went on and the weeks went by. We didn't go over the top, we just did this dull routine. Complete boredom with odd spasms of fear.
At night, one would hear the crackle of musketry far away. And then these, what I call the lilies of the dead, the flares going up and slowly sinking down and giving this powdery greenish light. They were sinking down under parachutes. German lights much better than ours. And they would come down the line, you'd see them, and you'd hear the machine guns going, and they'd sweep down, we'd be ordered to stand to, and we'd fire into no man's land, about 80 yards from the Germans, and we'd see perhaps figures darting about and coming forward and then lying flat and then going back. And this would go down south at a great rate, travelling about 15 to 20 miles an hour, I should think. Then it would die out. It was known as the nightly wind-up.
War is boredom more than battles. Hard labour more than flag-waving bravery. On an average day on the Western Front, you'd not see a human being above the ground. The night was when the trench cities came alive. All the tasks that were too dangerous during the day needed doing. Surveying enemy defences, recovering wounded, repairing barbed wire, rebuilding trench parapets, moving supplies up to the front line, concentrating troops before a big offensive, manhandling guns into position, and listening to every move on the other side, trying to tell if the Germans were doing the same.
The idea was to go over to a German listening post, which is about 50 yards in front of the front line. The front line, by the way, is about 200 yards away from our front line. And so we had to go about 150 yards to get to this listening post, which is only occupied at night. And we had instructions to bring back 2 prisoners. And so we blacked our faces, and we had to go over the top at half past 11 in the middle of the night. And it was pouring with rain, of course, the usual mud and filth. And eventually we had instructions. No one was to make any sound. We crawled through the mud on our stomachs, and you don't show anything at all. The German trenches just in this 200 yards. And as we went over, of course, there were the odd stray bullets whistling overhead. But we managed to crawl along.
I used to have to go out and crawl on my belly along the front in no man's land, listening, and crawling a bit further, get like as near to Jerry's lines, although a long way off still, you know, but venture as far out as you could, so that you could get back pretty quick and listen.
And we crawl up the trench, apparently unseen. We could hear the Germans talking in this trench. And at a given signal, we made a dash under the wire and dived into this trench. Took them completely by surprise, and we managed to grab 2 Germans. There only appeared to be about half a dozen of them there. Knocked out the others, and then we started back to our own lines. But in the meantime, the Germans had got over their first shock, and they threw a grenade at us. So, of course, we had to throw one back. In the meantime, our own troops on our own front had opened fire, and then they gave us a suspended covering fire. The German line, of course, opened up, and we just lay in shell holes. We'd agreed that when this started, it was bound to start, the best thing to do was to simply lie quiet in these shell holes.
The rains kept on. We were in yellow clay. The water table was 2 feet below. Our trenches were 7 feet deep. We walked about, or moved very slowly, in a marne or a pug of yellow, watery clay. When the evening came, we could get out. It took about an hour to get out. Some of our chaps slipped in and were drowned and weren't seen until we trod on them, perhaps later. Well, we were relieved after the fourth night, and some of us had to be carried out. I noticed that so many of the tough ones were carried out, and the skinny little whimpersnaps like myself somehow could, perhaps we hadn't got the weight to carry, but we got out somehow, and we marched back, slouched back. And we got to our billets at Plug Street, a mile and a half away. And we just fell on the floor and slept. Equipment on, everything. Mud-slabbed overcoats, boots. Just dead meat.
After time, the fire more or less died down. And the extraordinary thing was all the bullets appeared to be very high up. And there is a tendency at night for troops to fire high rather than low, which, of course, I suppose saved us, really. And we eventually crawled back this 100 yards, and we sort of fell into the trench with our two prisoners, and they turned out to be Bavarians. We sort of marched them back to the CO's dugout, and we were simply plastered in mud. We were in an awful state. You can imagine what it was like. And we spent the rest of the night taking this mud off ourselves and trying to get it cleaned up.
And in the morning, all our parcels and letters and cleaning equipment, and we could go in Estaminets and have cafe rum for about a halfpenny and omelettes. And it was great fun. We had to go working party tonight in the wood. That was all night long. And after four more nights, we were in the trenches again, back slithering into this Hampshire tea trench and doing it all over again.
We'd start the day off stand two, which would be about half an hour before daybreak. We'd all be stood up to the parapet, looking over, waiting for Jerry to come, if he was going to come. After it was light enough, we'd stand down. The sentries detailed would stay at their posts. The rest would get down to whatever work there was. If there were sandbags or trench work to be done, anything like that would be all right, but the rest could get their heads down and doze, because we'd been very busy during the night. Come the morning, it was a shame to waste so much time sleeping. In any case, nobody would let you sleep. You got into the way of doing with very, very little sleep in the trenches.
World War I on the BBC, on TV, radio, and online.